From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
It's seed catalog season when we gardeners in many regions may not be able to grow much outdoors, but can dream big as we browse their pages and websites. It's also the season of my annual seed series, and this week my friend Ken Drews, author of Making More Plants, The Science, Art, and Joy of Propagation, is here to help us all get ready for a successful season of growing from seed. More with Ken in a moment, but first, this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
I almost forgot to say Happy New Year to all of you, and Happy New Year, Ken. How are you?
Older.
Oh, really?
Oh, I know. People keep saying Happy New Year, and I just think...
I know. We're ancient. So we should tell everybody the backstory here. We solicited this year for the seed series, we solicited reader and listener questions over the holidays about growing from seed. And we want to thank them for, we got like a bushel of them, didn't we?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And we got so many good topics from everyone that we're going to do two shows, this one this week and one a couple of weeks hence, to sort of try to cover all the subjects. And we're going to give away a copy of...
Oh, Making More Plants?
Each time, yes, in a giveaway on awaytogarden.com with the show transcripts. I love your book, and I know it's a wonderful book. It's got, I mean, it's not just about growing from seed. It's about propagating of all kinds, yes?
Mm-hmm.
And so in this first show, maybe let's talk about kind of getting ready. Let's do them sort of chronologically, like the planning, the gear, the getting set up once and for all correctly so that you can have success. Because a lot of the questions centered on that, not to my surprise, you know, because we all have issues with the technical. So, I mean, first of all, a great question from Madeline was, okay, she says, what's the biggest waste of my time to start as seeds? I want to grow so much, but when should I just start with transplants? And that's a really good strategic thing to think about first, isn't it?
Yes, and you're making me think of exactly that problem. You know, you look in the catalogs and you think, oh, that okra, that's so pretty. Oh, look at that big red okra. And then you grow okra and no one will eat it.
Yeah.
And so don't grow something no one will eat.
Right.
How's that?
No, I think that's true. And similarly, for me, there's like a mathematics to it in economics. You know, I have X square feet of, I have raised beds, you know, I have X square feet in the sun of raised bed space, and it takes this amount of time or that amount of time to grow a this or a that crop over however many square feet. And, you know, certain things cost $3 a pound or more, and certain things cost 79 cents a pound, and I can get them all the time. You know what I mean? I want to grow what's special, different, either a variety I can't get anywhere, even
right,
if it's of an everyday crop. But stuff like zucchini, I mean, am I going to give it 3 feet by 3 feet, to, you know, or I'm going to buy four zucchini from the guy, my farmer neighbor down the road, because he's always got zucchini in the summer. You know what
and
I mean?
And always needs to give it away.
Yeah. So I think there's like a math to do, and I think it has to do with availability and, like you said, desirability. Like, do you want it? I mean, if you like cooking a certain cuisine, you need those herbs, right, if you can grow
right
them.
And also go to the farmer's market, and if there's something that a local farmer is growing and growing really well, maybe you want to support that local farmer.
Yes.
And, you know, don't grow that if it's easier to get.
Yes. When 5 or 6 years ago, a number of young organic farm families moved to my town, and one of them specializes in potatoes and one of them grows a lot of tomatoes as part of their thing. And I rested my soil. It was great to be, because those things are related, and it is good to really rest your soil and not have those every year, you know, for pest and disease issues. And I started, you know, buying big bags of potatoes and putting them in my, you know, my fridge for the winter, and growing buying cases of tomatoes. You know, they were organically grown in my neighborhood, like you said, and mm-hmm, I'm supporting them. And yeah, so I think that's right too, is what's available locally from people you wish to support, especially. So.
Right.
So I asked people about what oddball seed projects they've tried, Not that you and I have ever done anything crazy with seeds. I know you've tried some really nutty things. Should I say that? Ha ha, nutty things. Like what, Ken?
Well, once I soaked a coconut in the bathtub for 6 months.
That's a big seed. What were you trying to do?
Well, the coconut palms are really beautiful. And actually now I see them from time to time. You know, people get them at the flower market. And they push up a stem and a leaf before they have a root. So I soaked this thing and I soaked this thing. And it did split and something started and then it died. So for 6 months I had a coconut in my bathtub.
That's crazy. You have had used your bathroom plumbing for other, if I remember correctly, didn't you, what did you hang in your toilet tank? Didn't you do some crazy thing?
Oh, you're going to have me tell this. Okay.
Well, you told it to me before, so it's a half memory.
I know. Okay. So I really love, maybe it's my, I shouldn't say favorite. I really love odd Jack in the Pulpits and also the local Jack in the Pulpits. Those are Aracema.
Yeah.
In the genus Aracema. And I remember when I started my garden, you could buy a tuber of a fancy Aracema for like $30 for one tuber. But you could get seeds. And you could get seeds from England. And you could get seeds from the exchanges like the North American Rock Garden Society,
yeah,
where you give some seeds and then you get some seeds. And these seeds, ordinarily, when they start, and the ones that I grow myself, they form in a kind of a berry. And I know it's a long story, but if you take off the flesh from the berry, then those seeds are going to sprout right away.
Right.
But when you get the dry seeds from an exchange, they don't sprout. They're cleaned of flesh, and they're dry. And so I tried and failed and tried and failed and tried and failed. And finally, I asked someone who's in the North American Rock Garden Society, how do you start the Aracema when they come dry? And he said, oh, it's really easy. You have to rehydrate them. You put them in water for 2 weeks and you change the water 6 to 8 times a day so they don't rot.
Oh, yeah, I'll get right on that.
Well, he's retired, you see.
Yeah.
So I'm always, you know, I'm always cooking up something. So I put some of the dry seed in an organza bag and I hung it in the tank of the toilet.
Okay, that's
important,
what it
not
was.
The bowl.
Right.
In the tank with
right.
a paper clip.
Right.
And I just left them there for 2 weeks and the water gets freshened.
Yeah.
6 to 8 times a day. And then I took them out and sowed them and they all came up.
Well, okay, so that would qualify as a nutty seed experiment. I mean, we had a couple of readers, listeners who wrote in. Linda tried water chestnuts, not a giant success. Carol, cardoons, which she really loved, beautiful and really successful. And she's also had good success with growing artichokes in the mid-Atlantic regions, she says.
Ooh.
So she took a crack at cardoons and she just loved it, you know, wonderful ornamental. And really, really loved it as well as edible. So that was kind of fun for her. So those are two that people shared with us, which made me think of the wanting to hear your crazy ideas.
I think I'd do the water chestnut just like I did the Aracema.
Yeah, similar.
I actually found water chestnuts on the banks of the Hudson River north of New York City.
Oh, cool. So I suppose the first sort of overall question is, what to start indoors and what to direct sow. And we're going to do more on sort of the things that we sow outdoors in the second show that we're in the seed series. But just why do we start indoors? We start indoors because you and I are both in a cold zone, right? And we need a head start, mm-hmm. especially on warm season crops like a tomato, a pepper, an eggplant, whatever, basil. So we do it to get a head start, right? I mean,
right.
generally.
And with a lot of those plants, we don't have a choice because they won't take the cold.
Right.
Any cold.
And they need too long a time to grow up to maturity for us to direct sow them once it's hot outside and warm enough outside. So we
right.
do it that reason. And then throughout the season, wherever you are, you may keep a supply of seedlings coming because sometimes the soil's too hot and dry outside to germinate any kinds of seeds or especially certain cool-loving seeds. So sometimes we keep, you know, it's easier to, like in a sort of semi-shady place, to grow more lettuce seedlings all season long or more kale seedlings all season long than to put seeds into hot, dry soil and have them dry up and die, you know, not germinate. So that's another reason. But a lot of the questions we got had to do with gearing up, you know, again, no surprise, starting with the germinating mix. You know, Catherine wanted to know what the best seed starting soil mix to buy was. And her complaint really was that the common ones she's used have what she calls rubble, you know, large bits of bark or whatever. And she has to sift those through. Otherwise, it sort of impedes smaller seeds. And other people sort of chimed in and said what they've been using. Caroline wants to know what our recipes are, if we make our own medium. And some people had specific, like KP asked about a particular one that Craig Lahoulier, the tomato expert friend of ours, and a lot of other people have recommended the Johnny's Selected Seed 512 mix and why to use that. What do you use?
Well, you made me think of like a million things as usual, because I think that the mix that you buy at the store with peat moss and perlite in it isn't really so bad. And I bought that, you know, years ago, and I'd add some coarse sand or some grit to that because it does pack down. It kind of gets swampy unless you open it up. I haven't found things to be too big, but for many years now, because I'm peat free, I could say. I've been using coir with perlite, and you can now get coir that's very finely chopped. But until very recently, I would take coir and maybe even compost and rub it through some hardware cloth, like quarter-inch hardware cloth, which really makes it come out quite fine. You just rub it back and forth. I suppose you could do it if you had a very coarse sieve.
Right.
So I make that fine, and then I'll add some very coarse sand or some fine chicken grit to that to open it up a little bit so it doesn't pack down too much. But if I'm using compost or if I'm using coir that's been around for a while, I sterilize my mix. And I guess that's getting into the whole idea of cleanliness.
Yeah, which is key for seedlings to not transmit disease. Right. Right. Because like John asked, he said, can I use, you know, he said he wanted to know why fresh, clean potting soil is often, potting mix is often recommended for starting seed. And when he has old soil from failed attempts, can he refresh it somehow? And what you're talking about usually, which is a heat method to sort of pasteurize or sterilize it, it can be real stinky if you do it
right
with old soil, really stinky.
Or any soil, actually.
Yeah.
It'll fill the house.
Yeah. So
and that's what usually you find recommended, that people put it in a pan in the oven, and you want to get it up to about 160 degrees, which kills most of the pathogens. But when I was writing Making More Plants, I started putting my mix in the plastic roasting bags that you can get for turkeys or pot roast or brisket or something at the supermarket. And I put it in the bag and leave plenty of space because it will have steam. I put it in moistened. Mm-hmm. And I close the bag with the tie that comes with it, and I put it in the microwave on full power for about 10 minutes. And I usually use an instant read thermometer to see if I'm up to that temperature. But when I open the bag, you have to be really careful because it's filled with steam and you could get burned.
Yeah.
But that's what I do and I do sometimes reuse mix, but I sterilize it.
Right.
Or, you know, as you said, pasteurize it.
But really don't do this in the oven in the way that, you know, that's going to stink up your whole house.
Well, you could do it with the bag in the oven.
Yes, but that what I meant is in like an open baking pan or something. That's like a roasting pan. That's not going to be a good thing.
Unless you're, you know, moving out for 2 weeks.
So as far as the Johnny's, that's what I use is Johnny's 512. And the reason being is that it's got sphagnum, it's got sedge peat mosses, you know, black peat mosses, it's got compost, it's got perlite. It does have some nutrients.
Oh my.
But it doesn't require, it's easier to wet it and it stays evenly moist. So it's a good texture, you know, and it has good soil absorbency. So it's also good for soil blocking. And we did have a question or two about soil blocking, you know, making your own little sort of, they're not pots, but, you know, bricks of soil to sow into. And so some mixes don't hold together for soil blocking. So you've got to look on the bag if you want a soil block, whether it's it's adapted to that. And Johnny's 512 is good for that. So
you haven't had any problems with it having nutrients in it?
No, it doesn't seem to be like, you know, nuclear, you know, like you know what brand and you know what brand from that chemical company.
Yeah, the seed starting mixes, if they have, you know, if it's commercial and you get it at the box stores and it has any fertilizer in it or has the name of a fertilizer on the package, don't do it.
Yeah, don't do it. I agree, because not all seeds need it or want it, and it can be...
None of them need it.
It can be really bad for them, in fact.
It burns
them. Yeah. So, or can just push them too fast or whatever, I think. So, I wanted to sort of compare... Okay, so now we have a medium. We've talked about your medium, what I use, what you use. I wanted to compare sort of our gear, you know, what kind of pots, flats, cells, tray, what's your general gear? Like, are you using cells or what are you sewing into generally?
Most of the things I do, I sew a lot of seeds in a 3.5-inch plastic pot.
Uh-huh.
And I use square because you can get more of those in a closer, you know,
in
closer
flat,
together.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
In a flat, right. And if they're round, they fall over, but mm-hmm. they're not. So I use square pots, and I use 3.5-inch. And as I said, sow a whole lot of seeds because I'm going to pot them on. I didn't want to say prick them out, mm-hmm. or I don't cut their heads off, which
right.
is what you sometimes do in the garden row
right.
if you're direct sowing. But I do remove them once they have their first true leaves, which is the second set of leaves that resemble the leaves of the adult plant. And I move them to cells in a, I hate to say plastic, but what else is there?
It's plastic. Yeah, yeah. I buy the heavier grades so that I've had some of them for 5 years. I don't buy it every year,
yeah.
the junky stuff.
Good.
Right. I sometimes sew in fiber pots, you know, like small fiber pots. They're kind of a small rectangle. I don't know if they're 8 inches by 6 inches or something like that. You've seen them. You've probably bought things at the garden center in them. I use these fiber pots because, like, sometimes I just want to do, you know, 6 or 8 kale seedlings or something. You know, I'm a small family, and I don't need a ton of something. I don't need a whole big flat. And I want to have... But I want to do a lot of different things, a couple kinds of kale and a couple kinds of lettuce and a couple, you know. And so it's kind of like a mix and match modules, sort of like a 6-pack, but without the cells. And I can divide them up like you're saying. I don't have to move them as quickly as you have to out of your smaller pots. But I use those sometimes too. And with stuff like onions, I use an open flat. I don't put it in cells or small pots at all. I do it in an open flat.
I've made pots out of newspaper with the...
Yeah.
I don't know. Have you ever seen those?
Sure. It's like
mechanisms?
A dowel. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you can, instead of a peat pot, which I hate, then you can take that and plant. Once you move them up, the seedlings, then you can plant that directly in the garden. And that worked pretty well.
Yeah. So germinating mats, real important to say. I don't know if you use them. I use them under a lot of things. But the name of it is the tip-off that I learned from a plant physiologist at Cornell, who studied seedlings, vegetable seedlings particularly, germinating mat. It is not a growing mat. It is a germinating mat. The minute that the thing germinates, get that bottom heat out of there. Young plants don't want heat. Even the heat lovers don't want their soil cooking. You know what I mean? It's a germinating helper.
Well, they get too long and leggy.
Exactly. Similarly, get that hood that... If you have plastic over your flats or, you know, one of those hoods, a clear plastic hood, that comes off to what would be called the germinating chamber in a laboratory. So both the bottom heat and the humidity dome or film have to come off as soon as your stuff germinates. One of the big reasons for seed failure. So I wanted to get on to light because a lot of questions, and by the way, Jamie had talked about learning the hard way that lettuce hates warmth in particular.
Yes.
But a lot of people had mentioned the heat thing. Sherry talked about spindly seedlings and what to do about them and would a fan help and, you know, et cetera. Other people mentioned spindly seedlings in their questions. And so light is super important, obviously, and windowsills are just, I think, a total no-no. Don't you agree?
Yes, even if it's... Well, I suppose if you had a south window and you've lived near the equator or something. In general, you just can't give them enough light.
Right.
On a windowsill.
Right. So, you know, all this stuff. And I recently did a great interview with Leslie Hallock, who wrote a new book about gardening on growing under lights and in 2018. And it explains a lot about the details of this. But generally speaking, and LEDs are coming onto the market more and more, and they're getting more affordable. But even the high output T5 lights or T5HO high output lights, the sort of thin fluorescent tubes in a mirrored hood, you know, a reflective hood on an adjustable thing frame, like the Jumpstart, inexpensive Jumpstart systems, or the ones from I'll never remember the name of it, never mind. You know, lots of easy ways to do it, but the T5 high outputs are still a really good choice. Much more light, but still not as much light as outdoors on a spring day. You know what right. I mean? So I carry my guys outside, and I'll give links to all that, to sort of my light protocol. But yeah, I mean.
Well, you know, you want to have the seedlings like 2 inches below the lights, and which people can't imagine. And if you have a light unit and it has chains, you can raise and lower the light. But then when you have different flats or trays and the plants are coming up at a different speed, and how do you do that? So I've been using plastic deli containers, the pints and the quarts. So I'll raise the flat using those inverted containers so that those seedlings are raised up to the lights. And if the ones haven't come up yet, and they're a little further away, then they can be a little further away, because that you can't have everything at the right place at the right time unless you're doing an entire 4-foot by 2-foot area with one kind of seed.
Well, and that's the other reason I like to use my fiber pots, is because I can have, if one variety is up and running, I take it off the heat mat. You know what I mean? And similarly with your little pots, you can do the same thing. When it's up, take it off the heat mat. We only have a couple minutes left in this segment, but I want to make sure we cover watering at least briefly. I loved my old APS system that used to be sold, sort of these foam compartments, and then they stood on top of, they had hollow bottoms, and they stood on top of a capillary, kind of a felt mat that dipped into a reservoir and self-watered. They're not made anymore, but there are things like Speedlings and Growies, and I'll give links to them in the transcript. But watering, are you a bottom waterer, or what do you
I
do?
Am.
Yeah,
I,
and tell
well,
us.
I water from the bottom. If the seedlings are up, and since I top dress, we didn't talk about that, but since I top dress with either chicken grit or very coarse horticultural sand, I can water from above, but I usually use what we used to call a bulb mister.
Yes, I use it too, yeah.
Which you can still find them, and they're not very expensive. People used to, my mother had one for ironing, you know, 40 years ago.
And I have a hand pump sprayer that is like 2 liters or something, and it gives you this similar kind of thing, and it's controllable, and it's small enough, the spray.
And it won't dislodge the
seeds. No, at all.
Generally, I just put, especially when I start, I'll sow the seeds, and then I'll place my 3.5-inch pot or several of them in a tray with about 3/4 of an inch of water. And when the grit on the top turns from light to dark, I take them out. It takes about a half an hour.
Yeah. So quick as a bunny, tell us why you put that grit on the top as a mulch to prevent what?
Well, I started doing this about 15 years ago. I really do it with everything. I put this kind of top layer, just 1 or 2 thick of chicken grit or coarse sand, and I haven't had damping off the dreaded fungal disease that
collapses,
makes the seedling keel over, right? I haven't had that happen, knock on wood, once since I've been using this inert material on top. It doesn't stay wet, and it doesn't encourage the growth of anything. So it's really just a miracle.
Okay. It's like having clean straw around your tomato plants in the summer. Those soil-borne fungal spores can't get up onto your plants. They can't splash up. Same thing. It's like a barrier.
Right.
Great idea. So Ken, we have gotten our first seed series episode done, and we will be back with another in a couple of weeks. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Good.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, your go-to resource for books in gardening and nature. Whether you're a new gardener, a professional at the top of your field, or a reader interested in the wonders of the natural world, their books are there to help you grow. TimberPress.com.
And thanks to all of you for listening, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy seed chopping and gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.